Well, you kind of, well, I mean, we're doing this. Today. We're doing the bloody interview now. But like, you did that in a...
Don't stop.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Everything interesting I've ever had to say has already been said.
It's in the can. I mean, we don't know.
We've just been chatting. That's how it should be. I mean, you can't just say, can you turn this interest off until the camera's rolling?
Just let it flow, you know, rather than turn
it off. Oh, I've been letting it flow for many, many years. Wait, that sounds disgusting. Okay, let's backtrack through all of that phrasing. Keep it. I was very happy when I got an email that just said, "Dear Murray, should have asked before we're bringing back Doctor Who. Would you like to see the music?" Immediately wrote back and said, "Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you." I think I rang my dad straight after and said, "He got in touch, Dad." So that's good. Bowie was standing next to me. And I just turned around to him and said, "I knew this would happen. I don't just go up to people, only you, because you've meant so much to me. And I left. I was the one who left. I was like, goodbye, Latest. David Bowie. I don't have any more time, I'm afraid." Yeah. How mad is it that we talk about your songs for Doctor Who? If anyone had said there will come a point where characters in Doctor Who break into song in the way that every now and again looks like it could be an episode of Glee. At one point, Matt gets up onto the top of a building and screams at a bunch of aliens, "I am the Doctor." When he says that, something has to happen musically that is going to be really memorable and identify Matt. So definitely the lovely series to do.
Hey everyone, I'm Billy and welcome back to Half the Picture. I'm so stoked to say that our guest this episode is none other than composer Murray Gold. Now, you may have heard of some of Murray's music before, if you know this. Or if you've heard this. Or if you've heard this. You know exactly who he is and why I was so excited to have him on the show. Now, I've been a fan of Murray Gold's work for years, since I was a child. I mean, he basically soundtracked my childhood with his music for Doctor Who, and I know many people can say the same, but also his broader career, working on shows like The Second Coming and Years, and Queer as Folk, of course. You know, he really dived into his working process as a composer in his broader career, and I think you're going to love it. Also, don't forget to like and subscribe to the podcast, as it really helps us get more amazing guests on the show. So, without further ado, let's roll on my conversation with Murray Gold. Enjoy. So, Murray, welcome to Half the Picture. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm quite good. I'm a bit stressed because I'm selling my house right now and there's literally waiting for a solicitor to call me and for me to authorise it, but I've turned my phone off so I can't. So this is more important.
Well, I mean, it's such a pleasure to have you on the pod because I've been a fan of yours since I was, I mean, we were saying before we started, but like, I've been a fan of yours since I was, you know, yay high, you know, whether consciously, I mean, before unconsciously. And then once I realized someone was actually composing the music for my favorite show, Doctor Who, I was like, this is amazing. You know, this guy's work is incredible. And I think probably most of us here in this room, you know, shooting this, recording this, could probably say the same thing, that you've soundtracked a good portion of our childhoods and even beyond that, you know, even into, you know, adulthood. I mean, you know, all of your work going back to Queer as Folk and Second Coming and, you know, Vanity Fair and Death at a Funeral and up till now, obviously, with like stuff like It's a Sin and Dead Ringers and, you know, and of course, Doctor Who, you know, running through a lot of that. It's such a pleasure to have you on. So thank you.
My total pleasure to be here. And I feel just really privileged, you know, to sit with, you've had a lot of people I really admire on this show. And it feels quite nice to be sat there beside them in the same environment, you know.
That's very nice of you to say, mate, because like I say, for us it's a genuine pleasure, and having listened to a lot of your music in the run-up to this chat, you know, like going back and revisiting stuff that I had listened to many times over the years and also rediscovering stuff that I was less familiar with, like some of your earlier work, it feels to me like throughout all of your body work there's been this constant sense of exuberance to it. Like there's so much sort of energy and vitality to it, you know. Of course, for a lot of people, that a lot of those tracks will be stuff like Doctor Who that people really gravitate towards, but even going back to the beginning and stuff like Queer as Folk and Vanity Fair, which you did the music for, you know, the Thackeray adaptation, there's such a sort of great sense of sort of rollicking spirit to it. And I guess I just wanted to ask as a kickoff, like, where does that sense of exuberance come from? Because it's like, no matter how dark a piece of music is that you compose, like whether it's for Dead Ringers or like, or even stuff like Midnight, an episode of Doctor Who, or Heaven Sent, there's always that kind of sense of passion to it. And I guess, where does that come from for you, that sense of exuberance?
I mean, that is such a brilliant brilliant question because it crosses over with so many different things. My personal history and, you know, just notions of what human beings are, ideas of what tone is in art and how important that is. What is tone? You know, is it that goes through you like DNA that you couldn't get rid of even if you wanted to, which I suspect is something of the truth with me. I mean, and there's also like philosophy. What is your philosophy? You know, when you think about an artist, what are they? What do they represent? What is their, I don't want to say brand, but what is their thing? Who are they? Mm. And can you see that? Can you hear that? And I mean, in terms of personal history, I would also, when I was quite young, I lost my brother. And he was 25, so just going in on a really big thing that happened to me. And I feel like I inherited all of this kind of what it... I started looking at life in a completely different way, and it was just at the same time as I started writing music professionally. It sort of almost gave me a direction to celebrate life in his absence. So let's just kick off with that. You know, I just... We're not here. It's such a big deal. We're not here for very long. We never figure out why we're here. We have a minuscule amount of time. It's like, I always think of it as we're in this book, which is the history of our planet. And we arrive in sort of chapter 107 and we maybe get to see how things turn out by chapter 109. And then there's another 1,000 chapters or so that you never get to read. And you just... Do your best in this weird sci-fi kind of thing that we call life. You know, you just wake up in the morning, don't know if you're going to. Anyway, just my tone of approach to everything is like, we're all weird. We're all stuck on this planet. I've got to be kind to as many people as possible because no one can get out of this easily. It's a struggle, you know. We were a middling form of human life, the Homo sapien, who went and destroyed almost everything that and became the top apex predator. This is a big answer, isn't it, to you? Didn't expect this, did you?
I certainly did not.
No, you know, I'm here for it. We weren't, the Homo sapien creature was not expecting to end up the apex predator, and it didn't have this sort of nobility and dignity of other creatures like lions and tigers who were the previous apex predators. We found ourselves at the top. We are still neurotic, uncertain, scared from our genetic DNA background as, you know, middling creatures. And here we are with all this power, but still with all these nerves and grief and not able to figure stuff out. And I just want to, in my tiny, 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 minuscule patch of earth, of life, just recognize that there's something to celebrate and to just, you know, be joyful about and be curious about, you know. So there you go. Goodbye. Thank you. And that was the end of the interview.
And that was it. I mean, see, now I totally understand why, you know, you're a composer of Doctor Who.
Right.
I mean, so much of that, you know, could have just come from the Doctor's work.
Yeah, but it would have been much better written.
Well, you said this thing actually once about Doctor Who, which I think links quite nicely to what you said, which is that like Doctor Who should brim with life. As a show, as a story, it should be brimming with life. And I feel like your music has always done that. It's always brimmed with life. And everything what you've just said there about how, you know, we're only here for a short amount of time, you've kind of got to grab every moment and live in it while you can and savor it, I guess. I hear that in all of the music that you've composed. Like I say, no matter how sort of somber or dark or melancholic a cue, it's always, there's that sense of life to it. Because I mean, going back to the early days, I mean, before you were, when you mentioned like when you started composing music professionally, for a long time you studied drama. You know, drama was originally what you were thinking of doing and music was a hobby. And then you decided to switch at some point and go into music full time. And I wanted to ask, like, what was it that brought about that switch? And what is the thing that made you just fall in love with music? You know, was it a particular piece of music or a composer or a film? Or was there something that just galvanize you to be like, this is what I want to do?
I mean, I was always in love with music. I grew up on a, you know, in Portsmouth. We lived on the top of a hill and it was a bit remote and we got broken into twice and it was a bit scary. And I, you know, like a lot of kids, just spent a lot of time in my bedroom listening to music. I wasn't unhappy. I was quite a cheerful kid. So I was very, you know, and but, you know, music is a magical, as a magical thing. It just, in some ways, it's like food, you know, that you can enjoy it totally on your own and nobody can tell you that what you've just eaten, you shouldn't have eaten and you shouldn't have enjoyed it because it tasted disgusting. Because you know what it tasted like and it did really great things to you as you tasted it. And music's like that. I will always just, I didn't really care if anybody else liked what I was listening to. I liked it. I didn't need to convince anybody else. I didn't need to proselytize on behalf of the artist. I didn't go into school telling people Bowie was the amazing. I mean, they probably didn't even know I loved David Bowie. But I just discovered him because an uncle had lots of his records in his collection. We had a babysitter once as well, got me into punk and Adam and the Ants when they were punk. And so there was lots of little things that you picked up on. But it's just about feeling, isn't it? Which I suppose is a form of pleasure. In being alive, you know, that's what feeling, good feeling anyway, that's what it is. It's the ability to just, you know, experience what being alive is.
I mean, speaking of Bowie, I mean, I remember reading that you once met Bowie, right? In New York, because you lived in New York for a long stretch and then you moved back to London. I mean, what was that like? I mean, Bowie being one of your heroes musically, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, I've met a lot of my heroes. I met Lou Reed. I met David Byrne.
Huge fan of Lou Reed. I love Lou. And Byrne, obviously, as well. Lou was great.
David Byrne was adorable. I mean, the other two are impenetrable and, you know, quite hard exteriors, you know.
Bowie and Reed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because neither of them should be gone, you know. They should both be here. They could easily have both been here. And then I would still be thinking, oh, I'd love to meet them again, you know, and just chat. But no, I was just one of just a procession of freaks that Bowie had met in, you know, just some weird guy just goes up and says how much he meant to him in an ice cream shop in Rhinebeck, New York. I mean, he was just standing there next to me while I wasn't paying attention, and I turned around and, you know, the whole place had gone ice cold. My girlfriend at the time was tugging on my hand and I didn't know why, and Bowie was standing next to me. And I just turned around to him and said, I knew this would happen.
And that was when he was like, oh, looking for the exit.
Yeah, freak. Okay, there's another one. Oh, my God. You know.
How did he react to that?
He said, really? In that sort of slight 60s South London accent that he still had. And then I had to just carry on as if I wasn't the person being the person I was telling him I wasn't. I don't do this. I don't just go up to people. I wouldn't, if, unless only you, because you've meant so much to me. And I just wouldn't, he's like looking like, I've heard this so many times. And I just looked down and his daughter was just, you know, choosing some ice cream. I just thought, I've got to leave him alone. I carried on, though.
Well, I want to say, didn't you mention, you talked a little bit about Doctor Who,
mentioned,
right?
Yeah, I said, he wanted to know what I did musically. I said, I write music, and I'd been writing the music for Doctor Who, I've said this before, and everyone's like, what did he mean? Like, he's turned around and said, I'm not doing it. And I said, what do you mean? He said, Doctor Who, they asked me to do it. And I said, well, I would never, ever think you would. And then I don't know what happened after that. Something else was said. But actually, a nurse at New York Presbyterian Hospital had told me that Bowie had been in not long before I actually met him. They have a VIP wing there, and she had rather indiscreetly told me that Bowie had been in and wasn't doing well, or hadn't been doing well. But so I actually just turned around and said, anyway, it's great to see you looking so well. You look fantastic. And I left. I was the one who left. I was like, goodbye. Goodbye, Latest. David Bowie. I don't have any more time, I'm afraid. I just thought I have to preserve my dignity and not be that person who just like crowds him out, you know. So I left. And then my girlfriend followed me and she gave me this photo. She said, look, I got you with him. I got the two of you talking. So that's been hanging on our wall, on the wall of everywhere I've lived ever since. And oh. I'm sitting there, standing there with my hand on my heart, and he, with his one good eye, is looking straight down the lens at the camera, thinking, I didn't authorise this, and that he looks really pissed off.
So that would have been, what, 2000 and the mid-noughties, 2006, 2007?
No, that's much later. This is like 2009, oh, I think. Okay. Yeah, so, yeah, not much later, but, yeah, around 2009.
They sort of slightly sort of wilderness years before the next day when he was sort of, I guess, sort of living in New York.
Yeah, we got back together with Visconti, and everything magically became good again before horrendously becoming bad again, you know. But those last two albums are absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. I was going to ask, do you have like a favourite Bowie? I mean, everyone has their favourite sort of version of Bowie, like era, album, tune. Do you have a favourite Bowie tune or album that is like your go-to?
Well, the last album is just, I mean, is the hardest to listen to. It's almost, you could say, the deepest. Lazarus. Is it called Lazarus, the album, or was that the single?
Black Star. But then there's the song and the album,
Yeah, so Hunky Dory would be my favourite, just historically, because, first of all, it's genuinely hit after hit after hit, and just beautiful. And it's Bowie at his most optimistic, his most, before the cocaine and the stardom really maybe, you know, darkened. I mean, he always had a very access to that, to a dark side, and there are still some tracks on that, on Hunky Dory even, but it's just full of joy, you know, and hope for children, you know, for his, for young, like songs like Kooks.
Yeah, I was just thinking about Kooks for that specifically.
Yeah, and optimism, and just, you know, I do think that optimism has to be the starting point for any work of art, you know, anything, no matter how horrific, no matter how dark it is, the very fact that you bother to do it and put something out there to the humanity has to be a vote of confidence in humanity to some degree, even if you're telling them how awful they are, you know, even if you're saying how violent and irredeemable the human race is, you're still bothering to say. But anyway, yeah, but that's got it's just got a lovely, lovely feel. You'll notice, I mean, I just get so sidetracked by all the time by philosophical things, like the weight, just the stuff of, I know I sound really pretentious, but it's a genuine thing. Like, I do think about death every single day. I mean, maybe that's a bad thing.
Well, I mean, that sort of, I don't know if the word is weight, but that really comes through. I mean, the sense you get with composers, I mean, I get anyway, is that like everything they can't say, they put into the music.
Yeah.
And I feel like with you, I mean, I hear you like saying all this, and then I can also hear it in the music as well. Like, you know, you just pour all of that.
So the person you're talking to now sounds like there's an overlap, like with that music.
Well, I guess like, because you think about these great sort of grand themes, I guess, like you say, you think about like death is kind of like Bowie going to Black Star, like that. You can't get a bigger theme than death. Like love and death are the two big ones, aren't they? And that is like one of the death is like the mother of all muses, right? I mean, like Bowie had the mother of all muses on that album to his own death to sort of inspire him. And I guess like those themes have always inspired great music or art or poetry. And
I mean Velázquez, all of, you know, you weren't allowed to do a painting without putting either a reference to a clock and a skull in your painting, just so that you actually told the gods that you weren't committing the sin of hubris by creating, trying to outdo God by creating something that lasts forever. So as an, you know, like creating a painting that lasted forever, I might, you know, I hope I've got this right, that a lot of the grandmasters would include a skull as a sign of humility to represent that, and also an hourglass, the phrase, the word. It's really lovely that you said that. I mean, about the music and that you can hear that, but I think, you know, it's quite simple music, and I've just tried to consistently sort of create a sound that, you know, makes people feel that, you know, aware of things, life, and happy, joyful things.
Well, I mean, linking that then to the stuff you've done, I mean, like the shows you've worked on, the sort of multitude. I mean, and focusing in, I guess on one of your key creative relationships, which is with Russell T. Davis, you know, writer, showrunner of stuff like Doctor Who, but also, as I say, Queer as Folk, you know, the first thing you guys did together, The Second Coming, which, by the way, I must say, like, I'm a big fan of that show, the stuff you guys did on it. It feels in many ways like a kind of warm-up for the stuff that you go on to do in Doctor Who, because it's you, it's Russell, and it's Christopher Eccleston playing this guy who basically claims to be the son of God, you know, this born again in the 21st century. And so much of that sort of territory that you cover in that show musically feels like a kind of warm-up for what you would do then 2 years later with Doctor Who. And I guess when Doctor Who came around with Russell, was it just sort of par for the course that he would sort of phone you up and say, hey, I'm doing Doctor Who, I want you to do the music? Because you'd already done these two big projects together. Was it just like, oh yeah, I'm going to be doing that next?
No, Russell, I never took it for granted, and I still don't. And, you know, it's not been the case that Russell's always called me for everything, especially at that time. You know, I was quite an inexperienced, I'd done Shameless as well, and, like you said, Vanity Fair, and a few things for Red Production Company. And, you know, I just didn't really know that it was out there as a job, that it was being remade. I heard that it was being remade, I think. I think my mum and dad had told me, actually. And they said, oh, it's Russell, and you should say something. But I never say something. I never go and ask or prompt or say anything like, oh, I'd love to do this or anything like that. I don't like to be a pest. I was very happy when I got an email that just said, dear Murray, should have asked before. We don't know if you've heard, we're bringing back Doctor Who. Would you like to do the music? And I just wrote back immediately, like I did when you invited me on this show. I just wrote back and said, yeah, I'd love to. Thank you. Mm. and then I think I rang my dad straight after and said, yeah, oh, he got in touch, Dad. So that's good.
I'm doing the show.
Well, I probably didn't say that, but I mean, he'd like me to do the show. Yeah. I mean, and always, you know, anticipate some disaster or it not working out or something, you know, getting in the way, but never say it will definitely happen.
Because you were a fan of Doctor Who growing up, I want to say, right? Tom Baker was your go-to guy. He was your doctor.
yeah. I love Doctor Who. I mean, there's loads of shows. I mean, I definitely love Doctor Who, especially from probably about the age of 4 to probably 11, something like that. So it was a long time in childhood. And then things started to get complicated towards the end of Tom Baker's time, and it started to get a little bit stuck. I'm not sure. Something happened anyway, and I didn't see much of Peter Davidson. He was still Tristram in All Creatures Great and Small for me, which would be on after Doctor Who, so that was confusing. He sort of migrated an hour earlier in terms of scheduling time.
He time travelled,
yeah,
in a sense. And then were you, as you say, you know, you were listening to music from such an early age. Were you listening to the BBC Radiophonic Workshop music for the show, and like, and Marquez and all those great composers who worked on it, and thinking, ah, this is interesting? Was that registering for you
as well? Yeah, I definitely thought it was an opportunity to get some analog synthesizer stuff in and adapt it for Russell's taste. I mean, you know, like maybe Stranger Things did that in the end. But I think I was probably anticipating more like what the soundtrack for Stranger Things is than what the music for Doctor Who eventually became, which was, you know, much more sort of acoustic instruments and eventually orchestral instruments. But I definitely listened to a lot of that before being told that's not what we want.
Russell and the top brass would tell you that.
I sent a 15-minute tape in of, you know, sort of what I was thinking for the show. And Russell and Julie Gardner listened to it, and I think the last minute of it had these sort of emotive strings, and they just wrote back and said, that's it, the last minute, that's what we want.
It was 15-minute tape.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was it about that? Was it just it was just such a different quality from everything else was sort of synthetic?
Everything else was definitely, yeah. I mean, even the strings were synthetic, but they were like, you know, it was a version of an orchestral sound, and the rest of it was sort of synths.
Because that first series of Doctor Who, when it came back, was the music for that series, when you go back and listen to it, is of a piece, and it's also kind of a certain kind of time. It's like, yeah, because like, obviously as the show got bigger and bigger and more successful and more people watched it, and I guess there was more money to throw at the show to like, yeah, we can get an orchestra on that rather than use samples. Like the music on that first series is very sort of strange and kind of like, as you say, kind of ethereal. And when I first watched the show, when it came back, and I had no reference point for Doctor Who at all, I guess it kind of skipped a generation a bit for like people like my age and younger, where like I didn't know what the TARDIS was, I didn't know what a Dalek was, those sort of iconic sort of pop cultural images that we know very well now. I had no reference point for that, and same with the music. So when I watched the first episode when it came back, it was the main feeling I got was this is just so strange and weird, and
yeah,
and the music, and even going to the theme, like that, the new theme that you rearranged for the show when it came back, taps into that real sort of sense of like it's adventurous but also incredibly just odd, and like, and kind of, and you don't know at first when you first hear it quite how you feel when you, when you, as you're listening to it that first time you hear it. I can remember very clearly watching it and going, I have no idea what to make of this. This is just so different.
Yeah, and I don't think it's necessarily just straightforward either, because I think cult things, you know, what you're describing sounds like how things used to be with cult shows, and they kind of infect you with their tone, and you're not sure if you like them, but they're so single, such a distinct tone. I think, you know, you just want to go back and look again because you're not sure what is it. That's just you starting a relationship with something. Again, like I said about music, it's just it's making you feel something, and you'll just find yourself going back to the TV to find out what is all this about. I mean, it definitely was a different tone to when I first, so what you would have seen in 2005 was a very different tone to what I first saw in 1973, which was the Green Death. And that had a much colder sort of atmosphere. But I think I liked weird. I mean, I think generally there was other culty shows on at the same time, like the Avengers and then the New Avengers, which was really, seemed really weird. I didn't really know who they were or what it was about. And then Sapphire and Steel was very strange.
Yeah.
I really loved that because I loved David McCallum, and he'd been in The Invisible Man, which I also loved because my superpower would always be to be invisible. Like, no doubt whatsoever, nothing else. You can keep strength. You can certainly keep flying because, frankly, I don't want that. I won't even fly in a plane, never mind with my arms outstretched on my own. But yeah, like, kids are weird, aren't they, as well, you know?
Yeah.
Kids don't know anything about how the world works. My children, for quite a long time, thought there was, when I asked them, how many people do you think there are in the world? They said 400. And I said, okay, so how do you figure that? And she said, well, there's seven others in our, there's 12 others in my class now. And then there's three other classes, so that's about 40. And then there's a few other houses on our street, so that's probably 100. And then there's the street we go to for our music lessons. So probably that makes 400. And I was like, what about, you know...
Can't fault that logic.
Other, if you consider, you know, I just love how mad that is.
Mm. But there is a kind of logic to it.
Yeah, that I mean, you can totally follow. She showed her working. I mean, this wasn't just some random figure plucked out of the sky. Also, you don't know that those things can't happen. You don't know that autons can't, you know, that shop dummies can't come. No one's. I mean, like, how weird is everybody when you're new, when you're just new in the world? And you see just stuff, and people are going on about Santa Claus, which, you know, so there's this guy who comes down the chimney and just then lets himself out with some reindeers. And they do believe in that because we've told them that's true. Mm. So, you know, like, why wouldn't shop dummies have seen, you know, real robots now? Why wouldn't they just come to life? Why wouldn't there be Daleks? I mean, actually, to be honest, there almost are now because they're, you know, we're about to have like automated war anyway, aren't we? So
yeah, tell me about it. Yeah, it's but, the web of fear.
But that state of childhood is just incredible. And sci-fi shows or cult shows, they just follow an alternative logic, which is basically just not a grown-up's logic where things happen in an ordered, sequenced, logical progression, which is also not necessarily any truth to that. That's just the truth of about 30 or 40 years of our lives, during which we're not either in the shadow of non-existence, I would call it, which is when we're really young, when we... My children still say, but where was I when I wasn't born? Where was I? I want to know. Why won't you tell me? And then, you know, later on in life, you're similarly, you can return to that, you know, you're closer to infinity. Mm. It's just our work years when we're just sort of like on a wage. People in those age groups tend to dismiss a lot of fantasy sci-fi, whatever stuff like that, as a load of nonsense. Mm. Well, you just don't know anything, though. You're dismissing things as nonsense, but you don't have any real foundational grounding in what reality is. None of us do.
Well, I think that was what was so great about the show when you guys brought it back was that you were taking it, you were treating it with sincerity, the whole thing, you know, for all ages. And I think you, Russell, did that, and you did that with the music. And I remember you saying once when you did Shameless, it was a very working class, you know, estate in Manchester, you know, quite a different background. You know, you grew up in Portsmouth, you know, very northern working class background presented in the show, and it was quite different to yours. But you still, when you approached it, you were like, these characters, you know, you have to take them seriously. You have to treat all their hopes and dreams and fears with total sincerity. And it's the same with Doctor Who. I mean, and with Russell, I think Russell was doing the same thing. I mean, I said at the start, you guys have worked on so many projects together. Like, what is it about Russell that keeps you coming back to work with him? Like, what is it that makes him so special?
Well, he's funny and he loves humanity. Mm. So there's two things. Neither of those things are true of lots of writers, you know. Lots of writers don't love humanity, but they, you know, find humanity interesting. Or I think Russell's really fascinated by humanity, and he's, you know, he's grounded in social realities as well. I do like that. I mean, I started off, like you just said, writing scores for sort of drama set in working class communities, mainly, and trying to find a bit of poetry for it. And yeah, I think you take everybody's testament for who they are seriously, you know. Otherwise, you just, you know, anyone who says anything about who they are and how they got there, it's you know, you can't laugh at that. That's that's everybody's story is like basically some form of struggle of how they got to be who they are, still be alive, whatever.
And Russell has that same quality too. And I guess, like, as I say, you guys have worked together for so many years now. Like, what is it that makes that relationship so special?
He's tremendously mischievous and fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, you could say more so at the beginning of Doctor Who than towards the end of it. I think if I had one thing I would say, you know, I would want Russell to do next is just throw caution to the wind and regain. You know, I think we're in a very tricky political moment, and I think some of that probably got him down, with every reason. I think that mischief and sense of fun are also two wonderful characteristics of Russell, the man, and of his writing. You know, these things are not you can't separate them. You can't separate Russell's personality. It doesn't pretend to be a funny, like, philanthropic, generous-hearted person. He doesn't pretend that. That's not just something he puts in his writing. He's not throwing his voice. I mean, you get a lot in television when showrunners like Paul Abbott or Russell, you know, they can't go on writing every episode of every series, so they need people who have a similar voice, and then they have to sort of slightly mimic the tone that they're in, and that's really hard for them. But anyway, so Russell's got, yeah, he's got a good voice.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, you mentioned something there, which is that, like, so at the start, talking about that voice. I mean, like you say at the start, where I guess there was everything to play for with bringing back Dot 2 because it had been off the air for so many years. And like the sense I get when I revisit those early series that you guys did is that you were all playing for keeps with the show. It was like we were the best chance we could give it to succeed and to stick around in the TV schedules. You know, we're going to take it and do that as best we can. And you did. And now, I guess, now that Dot 2 has sort of become more cemented in the culture and it's its place is now assured, I guess, in many ways. I mean, because it's still around and it has been now for, you know, 20 years now. I mean, would you say that Russell is playing a bit more cautiously? You mentioned that, like, there's a little bit, that sense of mischief is a little bit less, you know.
I think he has to just play it how he feels. I don't think he's feeling that sense of mischief or necessarily in the same way. I mean, there was a lot of knockabout humour in 2005 and fun and sort of like what you might call from 20 years later, sort of irresponsible fun. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, I enjoy that. I enjoyed that. And I think maybe the burden of, you know, Doctor Who's, you know, outsized influence on young people at this time maybe is inhibiting. It would have to be. You know, we're at a point where we're trying to define what young men are, which are at a point of, you know, trying to define what our society should be, and technologically where, you know, we're accelerating faster in the next 5 years than we have in my entire lifetime. So, you know, in some ways, Dot 2 is very well positioned to come back and deal with that, because it's the original technology show in some ways, you know. But, yeah, we'll see. I mean, I think we're at a precarious point for Doctor Who. I am hopeful that it's all going to be at the start of a wonderful new era. So I really hope that that's what happens.
On that subject, have they got you yet working on the music for the next, I mean, it's the next the Christmas special is the next episode, and then they'll presumably be more. I mean, have they got you working on that yet, or is it
I haven't heard really anything. I know that Russell's written, I think, multiple versions depending on certain outcomes, so that's all I really know, and I'm not sure I'm even supposed to know that. I normally do a very good job of not finding things out. So I make my job of keeping secrets very easy by never finding out in the first place.
Well, Peter said something when he came on, Peter Capaldi, we had on a little while ago, he said something interesting about Doctor Who in its current state, because you mentioned that he kind of felt that maybe over the years, as the show has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, now it is, you know, veritable phenomenon, then maybe it's become a little bit of a victim of its own success, perhaps, because when he grew up watching the show, you know, it was a much smaller scale. It was just, you know, it was on at 6 o'clock on a Saturday, or, you know, and it was Tom Baker playing the part of Peter Davison, and that the responsibilities of making the show and starring in it, producing it, creating it were a bit fewer, were smaller. And now that it's this, you know, it has, you know, its own conventions, it's always had its own conventions, but, like, you know, it's only gotten bigger in scale. And he was wondering maybe whether that is obviously that's a very good thing, you know, in many ways, but also it's become this sort of money-making machine in a lot of ways. And he was just sort of thinking about where it sits in the current sort of landscape in that respect. I mean, what are your kind of thoughts?
I mean, I think
that
it would like to be even more powerful. I mean, so would I. I mean, that would be great. I think, you know, you've got to remember that Mary Whitehouse had quite a lot to say about Doctor Who in the 70s, in what respects it might be corrupting the youth, or I guess that would have made, and it was, you know, expected to conform, probably, I don't really know, but to some kind of educational brief, you know, that it was continuing in some capacity to inform and educate. Now, you definitely, you know, well, the last few series, apparently more money has been spent. I keep hearing this. I don't really know. From where it is, it could easily have a golden age again. Russell just needs to think about, he is thinking about, no doubt, how do you position yourself in this culture right now,
when everyone seems to have an opinion about exactly that, I guess, like, and there are so many opinions, not just about Doctor Who, but I guess in general, like, yeah, how do you navigate that, I guess?
Like, yeah, I think making this kind of family show is especially difficult because Gen Z feels quite alienated from, or, you know, cut off from the rump of the rest of the living population. And so asking Gen Z to sit down and watch with their parents is a big ask, because it almost like maybe like the 1960s might be the last time that there might have been such a sort of gulf between generations.
It's interesting, because when I was watching Dot 2 and it came back as a kid, it was a family thing. I mean, that was the great one of the great successes that of the show that you guys put together, was it felt like a genuine family event, and getting everyone would sit down with their, you know, dinner on their laps and watch Doctor Who and be, you know, shit scared or you know, or elated, because you know, it was a blast. And I guess now I hear what you're saying is that it is a challenge to get people just to sit down and watch one screen all together, you know, generations. I mean, Russell always writes about that, you know, Years and Years in some ways is about that, which I know you did the music for as well. It is a challenge, I want to say, more and more these days.
Yeah, and linear TV generally is just sort of disappearing, although it is quite marvellous when it happens. Like, I'm not a huge fan of The Traitors, because it really, I find it uncomfortable to watch. And, you know, people keep telling me it's just a game, so the fact that it rewards deceit and just dishonesty is not a problem, because you're just playing a game. And I sort of, yeah, but it's real, it's actually so anyway, I have a problem with it, but at the same time it's rather marvelous that everyone, you know, there's something that everybody talks about, and it does seem to cross generations, and you know, people talk about it all at the same time the next day, and you know, and that's a really great thing. It's just a nice experience to have.
It's just a shame that the worst of humanity has to go on display to get everyone around the water cooler to chat about it.
Yeah, it's so sad watching people who presumably, you know, who just could really use the cash. And the celebrity ones, my family seem to really, really love it, so I am occasionally there. I'm just writhing around in discomfort. But anyway.
I'd love to hear what a Murray Gold live score for an episode of The Traitors would be like, if he just had, like, just start composing to the pitch and be like, you know, jagged strings well, and just Bernard Herrmann.
Give away the lies every time. Yeah.
Well, going into then the music you did do for Doctor Who with Russell, and then later on with Stephen Moffat, who took on the show after Russell left in 2010. I mean, your themes for the show, I mean, going back to the beginning and then up till now, have always been so memorable and so distinctive. I mean, and you have such a great knack for composing so many themes for so many different characters and making each one distinctive and memorable. And, you know, episodic television, as far as I understand, from a composing standpoint, is a tough gig, because you're having to compose so much music under quite a short length of time to, you know, for 13 episodes or more, or, you know, and, you know, all your themes for the different companions and the different doctors, of course. I feel like some of your most beloved songs that you've written are for the doctors. I mean, like, I Am the Doctor is eternally associated with Matt Smith, you know. Am I a Good Man is associated with Peter Capaldi. What is your process for devising those themes? And I guess, do you have a personal favourite of the themes you've done for those doctors, those five doctors you've done now, including Shooty?
So the process would be just to try and encapsulate something of what I'm seeing or reading in something that sounds suitable for the character of the Doctor. And they are in some ways all related, all of them, from the beginning. You know, they almost always are in a sort of harmonic minor key. I really loved how I Am the Doctor took off, and it was really fun. I always get really, really love I Am a Good Man as well. You know, I just really like how badass it sounds. And maybe that's just because that's how I felt about Peter. You know, that he was more uncompromising, and he needed something a bit harder. But anyway, yeah. I mean, I really like the Shooty theme.
Yeah, I love that.
Just try to do something different, but again, different but the same. You know,
Well, for me, I remember when I first heard that theme, I think when they debuted it, it was a live gig, a live BBC concert that they did. First played it. And I remember hearing it and thinking, this sounds like a sort of, if John Barry wrote a spaghetti Western theme, this is what it sounds like to me. That's sort of that big brass, but then it's got that rollicking kind of pace to it. And I just love that sort of vibe. And every time you hear it in that show, in those two seasons that Shooty did, it's like, oof, you know, it's like nothing else. And again, so distinctive from the others, from, you know, Peter's and Matt's and David's, you know.
I think because that concert that you saw it as, because I don't think we had any footage of the Christmas bell, or we didn't have anything to show the fans, so we thought it would be a good idea to just preview a couple of pieces of music from the new series, just to give it a taste of what everyone was going to be getting without actually, you know, spoiling Disney's, like, release schedule or anything like that. I made a sort of decision to bring the bass clarinet, and we got in a baritone saxophone into the orchestra because that's not a regular instrument for the National Orchestra of Wales. So somebody was hired to come in, and well, I was thinking of it visually, so I put these two instruments on either side of the podium, the conductor's podium, and as soon as we did that, it made that driving rhythm much more obvious to everyone who was watching, and that then subsequently fed into how I felt about the theme and the importance of that pumping woodwind ostinato, and how important that was. But it was like a visual thing, so it's quite interesting because no other theme ever had any visual element to it about how it looked when you watched an orchestra play it.
Well, I was lucky enough to go see the in 2013 I went to the 50th anniversary proms at the Albert Hall, which had for Doctor Who, which had all this incredible music, like, on stage being conducted by Ben Foster, who I know was like one of your key collaborators on doing that music, and then it was being played by the National Orchestra, and it was just fantastic hearing that big music in that huge space, the acoustics and everything. It was incredible. You said there about Capaldi's theme. I mean, what's for me so interesting about the themes that you do for those characters is that you've managed to layer in all these sort of textural elements of the characters so well, but in a very sort of implicit way, like with Peter's theme. And I kind of talked to Peter a little bit about this when he came on, I think a little bit, when we would talk about how he designed the costume of his Doctor, because you've got a very sort of austere sort of navy coat and the Doc Martens and everything, the brogues and the buttoned up sort of David Lynch sort of shirt. But then underneath all of that, he always had this sort of red inner lining of his coat, which was this sort of warmth. There was all underneath all that sort of bristle, there was warmth in his Doctor. Like, it's all, his whole character's there in like one outfit. And in his theme, like, you have that sort of very brooding kind of, like, you know, like I said, that kind of badass guitar on there. And then you have that sort of that middle portion where it's kind of twinkly fairy tale. Yeah. And it's all, and that's like the twinkle, that sort of almost Hartnell-esque kind of twinkle is there, secreted away, but it's always there. And then you have that big, that last section where it just builds and builds and builds, you know, that I just, those sort of textural elements. Is that something that you're conscious of when you're composing it? Like, you're layering in those elements.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was always like the rebirth thing, that the twinkly thing. I mean, we didn't use that enough, I think. There maybe weren't enough opportunities for it. It's quite subtle. By the way, was that red lining? Does that just make you think of John Pertwee?
A little bit, because I think he had a cape, didn't he,
John Pertwee, sometimes?
He did, a cape, and they had that velvet jacket, which I know Peter had later. He brought in the red velvet jacket on stuff like Heaven Sent.
That cape didn't have a green or red lining or something.
It was like a black cape with red in the lining.
So that's Peter's overcoat or... I get that line. That seemed to be referring to that.
I mean, on that sort of note, I guess, of like composing those themes, I mean, do you have like a favourite sort of piece of music cue or an episode that you've done the music for in Doctor Who, or like even broader, like a whole series? Like, is there a particular series of Doctor Who that you've composed for that you thought, that's the one? That's the one I'm sort of, I guess, the most closest to or the most proud of, or an episode? Like, do you have one of those?
I mean, the Pandorica double was... with the Stephen Moffat one, I loved that. There was just something about it. It was really, really well directed, and I really had fun with the music. I tend to just love the smaller episodes, you know, the slightly theatrical one space ones, or just generally the creepy smaller things. So right the way through, you know, obviously Midnight and Turn Left, and this from the last season, the well, and the one with the when they stand on the fairies sign and go to the weird Welsh pub.
73 yards.
Yeah, that one. Like just because it's, I just like that it's so weird. I just want to know. And then what happens, you know? And then what happens? And because it's Doctor Who and it's creepy, you know, it's going to end in a monster of some sort. And it's just, and that's, you know, I think the music tends to have more of a chance to sort of say something substantial in the smaller episodes, because there's fewer special effects, there's fewer spaceships crashing or whatever it is around. And you just have a chance to do something in some of the silences that are available. So, I mean, obviously, I also loved, God, my memory, I'm telling you, it's just grunts and pauses.
Heaven Sent? Is that the one you were going
to... How did you know?
Well, you were saying kind of small contained spaces, yeah. Not many aliens or special effects, quite contained spaces for the music to breathe.
I'm going to take this hat off because you're reading my mind. I hope this doesn't destroy the continuity or make all of your viewers just recoil with the sudden glare emanating from my head. Do you remember a band called Half Man, Half Biscuit?
No.
Great name. They used to have this song which started with these chopping indie chords, and it just went, Brian Moore's head looks uncannily like London Planetarium. Brian Moore was a famous bald sports commentator from the 70s, and I used to sing along, never dreaming that 30 years from then, I would look exactly the same.
I know that name Brian Moore because he's mentioned that Superhands and Peep Show references him at one point.
Oh, is he?
Brian Moore used to do the football on ITV. You know that guy, pack it in, son. Mugs game. That's what he said. That's like my one reference point for Brian Moore. So I appreciate your furnishing me with another one.
I've got a few decades of additional pop culture first-hand experience to reference. Yeah, I mean, yours is like you're getting it via Peep Show.
Yeah, exactly. I know. It's like second, third hand, you know. So, but you mentioned Heaven Sent there. I mean, because I was going to say that one, if I had to pick a single episode, I mean, it's hard because you've done, and also because you've done so many of them. You've composed, I think you composed more music for Doctor Who than anyone who has ever worked on the show, going back to the beginning. But Heaven, if I had to pick a single episode that is my personal favourite work of yours, I would say Heaven Sent, because I said this to Peter when he came on, but it feels like that episode was made with all the time in the world, to the best of everyone's ability who made it, like, you know, just trying to do their best work in some ways. It feels to me as a viewer, like, it's just, and I'm sure that's what every episode is like, you know, but like with that episode in particular, it's so special, and the music is such an I don't know if there's many other episodes of Doctor Who where the music is so integral. It's so integral to how the episode comes off emotionally, and the interplay between, you know, the music you're putting to the screen and what Rachel Talalay, the director, is directing and Peter's performing. It's magic. And I want to ask specifically about that episode, like, what was the process for composing the music for that one? And what's your, I guess now that it's been 10 years, because as you know, the episode has sort of become one of the most beloved of the whole show. And what's your relationship to it now after 10 years?
No, it's interesting because, like, if I had to do a live show, like in a gig type environment, that's one of the episodes I would happily just play on a screen and do the score along to with, you know, a gathering. Weirdly, the other two, Wild Blue Yonder, I would probably do the same, and Into the Dalek as well, which, I mean, I'm not sure if that score got the sort of attention, not that it deserved, but like that anyone really noticed it. But it was, at the time I was doing it, I remember we were mixing it at Air, and I just had everyone, because I was paying for the studio essentially, turn off all the dialogue, just sit back and just watch this whole thing unfold. And it was like, it was just a sort of analog, weird synthesizer odyssey type thing. It was a little bit Vangelis-y, but Heaven Sent, it's just a one-off. I knew it was going to be a one-off. You always know from the way that people talk about something in hushed tones before it arrives at my desk. And I'm sure Rachel didn't get any extra time to do it. I'm sure it was on the schedule and marked up with just the same ridiculously short amount of time to finish it and complete it as any of the other episodes. But I think it's just a little bit, I mean, I like sort of that kind of mode of sort of cyberpunky kind of, there's that online video game called The Room where you, have you heard of it? It's an app. It's an app game. And there were about three things, and it's about, you have to go through these different rooms, which have got all these great soundscapes in them of clocks and things. And they've all been furnished a particular way, and you have to, and a bunch of clues have been left by somebody who's steadily gone insane. And you have to find your way to the secret of the room. And it's weirdly creepy. I mean, I think this is maybe early noughties or something like that, just before I started playing Plants vs. Zombies instead.
Great game.
But yeah, there was something about that. You're just sort of going room to room in this maze designed by a lunatic, which I really, really liked. Or, you know, what's the Resident Evil's got a bit of that about it. But obviously very different tone. I do quite like the Resident Evil movies. I quite like the scores for them as well. They've got this like thundering, like acid techno-y stuff, which is really, was really groundbreaking at the time, I thought.
And so the episode with Heaven Sent, you kind of applied some of those same approaches to doing the music. Because when you mentioned sort of woodwind with Shooter's theme, the thing that I, because there is that synthetic element, but there's also this element of like, almost there are parts of that score which feel like almost like a Viking dirge. It's like, you know, this sort of funeral.
Of Heaven Sent.
Of Heaven Sent, yeah. Because obviously it's an episode about death, so you have that layered in there, that sort of dirge-like feel, which I love.
Stephen's a huge fan of Beethoven's Seventh, and there's the influence of Beethoven's Seventh is in there as well. There's a lot of slowed down, I recorded a lot of percussive instruments like these bells and just slowed them down a lot. It's quite interesting as well, because as well as having the slightly sort of romantic sort of classical stuff, there's just quite a few other bits and pieces, just little sounds in it, which make it all of a piece. And then, yeah, and then there's the Shepherd's Boy at the end, which really rounds it off.
Well, I was going to mention that, because that's one of your, one of the cues, I guess, from your work on Dot 2 there, is kind of taken on a bit of a life of its own. Like, people really love that track. And like, even when we were sort of preparing for this, I mean, like some of the guys in the office were like, you know, the Shepherd's Boy, you know, like really talking about that track. And it is an incredible piece. And it's also set to like one of the most brilliant pieces of editing that the show has ever had, that montage of Peter dying and being reborn and punching the wall and dying and reborn and going that cycle for billions of years, and you've got this music underneath it. And I wanted to ask about that, because like, where did that piece come from for you emotionally? And like, was it, were you composing to the picture, like that montage was there, that really rapid fire montage, or were you composing and then they were editing that to the
music? I think I composed to the cut version of it, so I had to make my changes come where the significant moments in the visuals happen, which is, you know, to be fair, what my job is. Rachel had tempted it with something, and there was some tonal similarities, but I just took my cue from, there was a sort of approach that she wanted, you know, this sense of, there's just a low simmering desperation, endurance, becoming heroic celebration, and it was, I did dig that tune out from the 50th anniversary special. So da 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 da, and I was like, God, I love that tune so much, and I was like, wait, that could be something more meaningful and meta than, you know, than it's where it sits in the 50th, and it's got a very different musical rhythmic setting. I just really loved that tune, and I wanted to make it the centerpiece. So that's where we're going to get to when he gets through after 50 billion years, because, you know, presumably if he's occupied 50 billion years one way or another, then, you know, in the special, which they've, all the doctors have been through this or something, I don't really know the answer to that, but I didn't want to just make up a piece of music, a tune, a melody for that moment, which was totally new. Mm. I wanted it to have been referred to before. You know, most Dot 2 fans go back to it immediately and they go, yeah, I know where that's from. Much more than I do. I never remember anything. I mean, it's just a sequence that's just so good. Like, to write music for, and I actually remember when I recorded it, and when we finally mixed it, it was like one of those ones that I really loved and wanted to play over and over to people. Mm. And again, like, if I felt that, I knew that there were other people who would feel that, but it wasn't... I remember my agent coming in and I said, you've got to listen to this. And bear in mind that all he does all day forever is listen to film music. And most of his clients are in Hollywood and stuff like that. And here I am doing a show I love. But he, you know, he, fair enough, it's decent, but it's not, you know, in the upper echelons of his client's work. And he just sort of listened. And I saw him just sort of nod off and start attending to something else. And I just thought... oh God, it hasn't got as much magic as I thought. And I was like, no, just bear with it. Just trust yourself. It's okay. So yeah.
And you were right.
there are things that have like, yeah, they've stood the test of time. I mean, people, you know, some of the, I mean, I know this happens to all musicians, so I'm not going to get and take it too much into my heart, but it does still mean something. But people say, you know, I got married to this piece of music, or I got married to the oud, or you know,
someone got married to the oud,
yeah, or just like we had a real tragedy and this helped us out, or some anything like all those things are real. Those are real things, you know. So yeah.
Well, that kind of, in a way, that kind of happened with me, because I said this to Peter when he came on, but like, Heaven Sent, that episode came out sort of around the time that both my grandparents died. And obviously it's an episode about death and grief. So I remember coming back to that episode a lot, not to sort of go on about it too much, but like, yeah, I did come back to that episode a lot in that period. And the music was a really key part of that for me. The beauty of it, but also the fact that it, like I say, it's so integral to that, the atmosphere of that episode. So yeah, it means a lot to me as well, personally. And as the, you know, all the music you've done on the show. And with Rachel, you mentioned Rachel Taddeley there, like, because I remember once, a few years after Heaven Sent came out, she was talking with some fans of the show on Twitter, and someone asked her about the music and like the conversations that you guys had, and paraphrasing it. But like, I remember she said something like, Murray, you know, he phoned me about the episode, and that very rarely happens, she said, because like, apparently Murray, quote unquote, never doesn't call directors much on Doctor Who. But he phoned and we had like a great conversation about it. And I want to ask, like, is that the case? Like, and what conversations did you have with Rachel about the episode? And do you often talk to directors on Doctor Who?
So the second part of that's easier to answer. The answer's no. And the first part, I'm sure I must have called Rachel if she remembers it. I mean, I must have just been read it and just sort of like, oh my God, this is amazing. What we're going to do? What we're doing with this? What's the deal? What do you want? What do you want from me? I mean, generally, there's not a lot of time. The time spent talking about something is time that is taken away from doing something. And referring to music that I've done is easier than trying to discuss what might be there. I don't know. I think what they call the spotting session, where you discuss moment by moment what you're trying to do, what your objective is as a director, I think that's a really overrated part of the process. Directors love that because they think it's that, you know, they want to be in control of what they're directing. I'm not convinced that television is a director's medium exactly, you know. It's maybe more so with Netflix and where we are in things. I think on series one, I spoke to every director. Mm. And by that time, I was like, I've got 13 or maybe 9 different people here that I've got to start new relationships with, who aren't coming back next year necessarily, who all want to take me out and go out for dinner and just discuss this and then hang out. And you multiply those days by, you know, 3 or whatever, however much time we have. We just don't, this is all pulling out of the vital time we have to write, to do stuff. So just thought, yeah, after series one, it was really hard to keep up with just to, you know, get the work done and delivered on time. So the director line of communication faded out.
But with Rachel, it was like when you saw the episode or the rushes, you were like, I need this deserves a conversation.
I think every now and again there's been repeat directors who then, you know, I start a relationship with, you know, because they earned it.
Well, there's something with that episode, like Rachel has such a strong vision with that episode, and like it's such a formal episode, and the way it's shot and the way it's lit and the way it's composed is very formal and almost kind of like an art house episode in some ways. The fact that it's a one-hander, and like I said, the music is so important to that, so I can understand why, I guess, wanting to be on the same page, I guess, in terms of like this music is working with these images,
yeah,
and in harmony, and to the best that they can, which to me it really does. They sort of sing together, those two.
Yeah, it's weird, it does feel quite 19th century, and I'm not sure if there's any reason. It's not set in any particular time, is it?
No.
And the building is way before the 19th century, but there's something gothic. Yeah, it's definitely it's a fun watch.
It's great, isn't it? Yeah, and with the sort of people that you've worked with, because you said, because of the setup of the show, you don't often have talk to directors about those individual episodes. I mean, do you often just, with the music, are you given more or less free rein to do what you want to do?
More or less, yeah. And the execs come back with notes. Sometimes directors have fed notes into the execs, so that's how they get it across. And when I say the execs, I usually just mean Russell or Stephen. I mean, they are definitely the ones that count. So, you know, if I want to push back, which I don't do often because it's easy to just make the changes, but if I want to push back about something, I'd just do it directly. When you're making something, I'm essentially a hired artist or an artisan. You have to be answerable to the person who's hired you. And, you know, that's it, really.
Well, the music does have that feel to it. As I say, it's that exuberance, but also it does feel kind of unchained. Like, it does feel like it's being composed with full throttle, just like you're just sort of expressing yourself. And it's like it's not being mediated by any particular person. It just feels organic, which I think is one of the great qualities about it. And you mentioned Stephen. Like, I did want to ask, like, because obviously we've talked a lot about you and Russell and your work relationship and all the different shows you guys have done. But when Russell left in 2009 and Stephen Moffat took over, like, what was your working relationship like with Stephen? How was he different to Russell on the show?
He's just a very, you know, affectionate, can be at least in appearance, irascible, highly intelligent, scarily intelligent human being. Just generally just says a few things that might have some notes, and just like told me to go get on with it, you know. He's lovely, just pretty much a dream. I think it was a lot of continuity, really. It was a change in the tone with Matt coming into the show, and you know, the type of plotting that there was. And I think Stephen loves humanity, but not in the same infatuated way that Russell does.
Which is interesting, because I've always thought of Russell and Stephen, comparing them, I guess, as writers, is that, like, Russell loves humanity, but he's also quite very honest about it. And, like, and I think his tastes kind of gravitate towards, I guess, more conventional, this is a very sort of big simplification, but I guess, you know, the dramas he's done, you know, he's like, our episodes like Midnight, he's quite unflinching about what humanity can be like as well, you know, the best and the worst. And I know, and Stephen over the years, obviously has given us so many brilliant, you know, like stuff like Coupling, you know, his comedies, you know, and he's so funny.
He's very funny.
Very funny.
I mean, I had to follow him in making a speech once. It's the worst possible thing. It was for a mate of ours' Oscar nomination party. And we went round the room, and Stephen just stood up, had the room just rolling in the aisles with off-the-cuff, completely unprepared remarks. I mean, I've seen him do that to, like, a group of people in the National History Museum with a huge number of MPs present. And he would just rib them and have them, like, and then, anyway, he did his speech, and then, Murray, if you'd like to speak now. I was like, oh my, just stood up and said, good luck, and sat down.
Yeah, short and sweet.
Yeah.
Keep it simple. Yeah, I mean, he's so funny and intelligent, and I feel like a lot of his, in a lot of the work he's done, the tenor seems to be predominantly comic, like I say, for stuff like Coupling and going even way before that, like, you know, Joking Apart and all those sitcoms he did, and then moving into Doctor Who and Sherlock, you know. But obviously you have that tempered with that steel, like you see in like Heaven Sent. Like Heaven Sent is not a light episode, you know, which he wrote. And when he came on board, I remember the feeling that fairy tale quality that Matt brought and Stephen brought. Yeah. And it was so sort of intoxicating to someone like me, you know, who I fell in love with that. And season five is probably, if I had to pick a favorite season of music that you've done, I love the soundtrack to season five for that sort of fairy tale quality. And you've always had that sense of mischief in your work as well, I think, and playfulness, which seems to just perfectly marry with Matt and his take and Stephen's take. And is that how it kind of felt when that series came through, when you were composing for that? Like, oh, this feels right.
You know? Yeah, it was a bit of a flexion point there as well, because it was all new. Everyone, there was a bit of a clear out. There was, you know, potentially the possibility for some distrust about anyone who was a hanger-on from the previous series, and would they go with the vision? And so that was potentially a moment of where it could have been a problem. You know, the opening shot of that long track down to that front door of that house was a fairy tale. It looked like a gothic horror. Mm. It was really nicely done. I think in the same episode, at one point, Matt gets up onto the top of a building and screams at a bunch of aliens, you know, go away, I am the Doctor. Yeah. And that was that kind of clutch moment where you like, okay, when he says that, something has to happen musically that is going to be really memorable and identify Matt. So it definitely was a lovely series to do.
And there are so many wonderful cues in it. And that sort of, the whole show seems to suddenly get the sense of like, yeah, like a shake up. And this is a new Doctor. This is a new sort of take on the show. And let's just sort of tear the rule book up and just throw it in the air. It was kind of, to me, it seemed like watching it, that seemed like to be the ethos. And going right from the top, the scripts to the acting to the music, you were reinventing yourself. And obviously that comes through in the main theme, the most obviously, like you have the main theme and you suddenly, it goes from being that sort of orchestral but sort of synthetic weirdness that we talked about to suddenly you got this big brass kind of riff up front, and it feels really reckless. And I remember like from that moment, oh, this is something completely different.
Yeah.
And was that a conscious thing? Like, let's just go nuts and tear the rule book up.
No, it's weird ourselves. Because we were doing that in 2009 at the same time as we were doing, I think, probably Valet d'Etchem. Did we follow straight on? We had the specials in 2009, and I think David Tennant, But I Don't Want to Go, was it Christmas Day 2009?
New Year's Day 2010, yeah.
New Year's Day 2010, and then March 2010. So I wrote I Am the Doctor in October 2009, and I think recorded it at that recording session. Before we'd actually even said bye to Tennant. So it was like, I think maybe the only time I was simultaneously working on two Doctors at the same time. Maybe there was there any overlap between Schutte's Christmas special and Schutte and David Tennant coming out of the same body? Not sure, but anyway. So it was quite weird though, because we were still in grief from Eros Lynn's, he was a director I would always speak to, and Joe Hearn. You know, for me, it was still like we were very much in the grief of saying goodbye. And, you know, but we were all about new energy, though. We want, this is like the show, we want, don't worry about goodbye. Did the TARDIS crash down to space on 1st of January, 2010,
Tennant blows
so
up.
So in that episode, there was already a new cue with hints of Matt Smith's music in it, you know, within seconds of possibly the most heart-rending moment in Doctor Who history.
Yeah, it's the biggest tonal whiplash I think the show has ever accomplished.
It's awful.
It's amazing.
It's
no,
so wrong.
No, but it works because like you have. I was rewatching it the other day. Like you have this incredibly heartrending moment, as you say, like Valley Death Shame, kind of like the Tenth Doctor's my way. You know, this is like I did it my way.
Absolutely.
And it regenerates, and then suddenly, I mean, like you get this new guy, and it changes completely on a dime from being like the most heartbreaking moment you've ever seen. I remember watching it and being like, this is so moving, and then boom. You suddenly get Matt coming in and the complete tonal whiplash from that. Only really a show like Doctor Who can do that, attempt that, and then get away with it. And I think the music is so important to that because you're suddenly into the next thing. You're suddenly just crashing headlong into, literally into the next series.
Absolutely.
And musically, that's how that works, I think, is that you get that next cue. And like, in a way, I mean, I don't mean, sorry, David, but you've almost kind of already forgotten about like what just happened.
The first comments online would likely be, oh my God, did you see what's coming? And as if we hadn't just sat through the 10th Doctor saying goodbye to Wilf or, you know, or going around saying goodbye to all his friends, you know.
Yeah.
And, but nope, here it is. There's funny old Matt Smith plunging to Earth. I mean, it is mad. I do miss the digestion that, you know, I'd like to have after, you know, saying goodbye to someone I loved. At least give me like 5 seconds to recover. Just give me something. But yeah. It does make, it makes sense because that's the show it is.
I mean, and speaking of goodbyes, I mean, I was thinking about this when I rewatched Twice Upon a Time, which is obviously not only Peter's last episode, it was Stephen's last episode as showrunner, and it was your last episode at the time.
Yeah.
As I say, at the time, and then you came back. The episode ends where after Peter regenerates into Jodie Whittaker with like, there's a little callback to the Doctor's theme. Right back, there's like a little drop of that from which I think was one of the first cues you ever composed for the show in 2005. Yeah. And like you just hear that classic sort of, I guess, Murray Gold Doctor Who theme a little bit, and then that's it. And then Jodie's coming in, and it's a new composer, it's Segan, and then Chris Chibnall. Like, was that a deliberate part on your part? Like, I want to get a little bit of my original.
No, I had nothing to do with it. Chris decided to put it in.
Oh, really?
Yeah. At that point, they hadn't hired a new composer yet.
Right.
So, you know, they couldn't ask anybody else to do anything for it. And in a way, it made sense because that was the first piece of music for when the show had returned. Might also be the only piece of music that, other than the Doctor Who theme itself, that's been in every incarnation, generation of the Doctor since Chris Eccleston.
But that wasn't the order. He just laid that in.
Yeah, I didn't know it was there.
Because it feels like such a wonderful closing of a loop, in a sense, musically.
Yeah.
You know, tying back to the very beginning of your time on the show, and then, you know.
I think it's sort of ceased to be Christopher Eccleston's theme now, and that's become a sort of general Doctor's theme. The timeless character of the Doctor is that theme. So whenever it's used now, it tends to be for something that's going very doctory.
Yeah. But then, of course, you came back. You know, Russell came back in 2023, and then you came back to do the music for Shooty Seasons. I mean, was it a hard sell to get you back? Did Russell have to fight Tooth and Nail to convince you to come back? Or was it just like I'd love to do this again?
Yeah, I mean, they knew I'd say agree to do it. I mean, I'd done a few things in the interim. So we'd done A Very English Scandal, It's a Sin, and Years and Years. So Russell had been prolific since leaving Doctor Who. I'd done all of those as well, plus other things. I went to bed one night and I saw an email from Julie saying, can we call you? And then I didn't reply because I was going to sleep. And then my phone rang and I just didn't pick up because I don't know. I was scared. It was late at night. Somebody from America who's living in America calls you and it's like COVID-y time. I don't know. I didn't know what it was going to be. You know, what are they going to say? You know, so I didn't reply. And then I think they wanted to get to me before it was announced that Russell and Julie were coming back. So the next day that was announced, but I still didn't know because I don't use social media or follow it. So I never know what's going on. And then Julie was on the phone saying, well, you've probably heard by now. And I said, just heard what? And again, fearing the worst, like who's died or something. And then I just looked online to see, to make sure everyone was all right, to make sure no one was dead. And, you know, I saw Russell and Julie surprisingly returned to Doctor Who. And I was like, I put two and two together. And then they rang and I said, yes.
And that was it.
Yeah. And I said, this isn't even my brain. This didn't even pass through my brain. My spine made the decision.
It's a reflexive
kind of. The hypothalamus. You know, so yeah. I mean, Russell and Julie are great. So, and you know, I would never turn down Doctor Who. So, you know.
And like I say, we've got a Christmas special coming this year, and then Russell's, you know, developing plans for where it will go next. I mean, are you keen to, like I say, like stay on that train and keep on inventing new themes and new music and just like...
Yeah, I mean, if someone asks me and says, do you want to do it? Of course, I would always say yes. I don't think I'd ever say no to Russell anyway. It's fun, even when it's hard. It's even when it's categorically the opposite of fun. It's still fun.
Well, that reminds me of when I remember you said once that Catherine Jenkins, the Abigail song that she sings in the Christmas special, Christmas Carol, which is one of your most beloved songs on the show, that was written in 2 days, I want to say. Like they told you 2 days before recording.
And you read the script? By the way, you've read. And And I said, yeah. And they said, so you will be aware of the big song that clinches the end and that is sung in vision. And I said, oh yes, oh, it's going to be fantastic, let me just go and check. And they said, so is there any chance we can hear it? Oh yes, I'm just putting my finishing touches to it. But by the way, how mad is it that we talk about the song, you know, your songs for Doctor Who or songs? I mean, if anyone had said in, you know, the 90s or in the early 2000s or even in 2005, you know, that there will come a point where it's quite normal for characters in Doctor Who to break into song.
Yeah.
Or for there to be, you know, specially composed songs for characters to sing or reflecting the journey of a character, whatever it is. And now it's, you know, that's how much it's changed. That's one of the most incredible changes that this, I mean, wonderful, but quite dry in tone, you know, quite scientific, quite, you know, just, anyway, we all know what Doctor Who was. It certainly wasn't one where people came out singing.
No.
There is something in Gunslingers, I think, maybe, a song in a bar. But anyway, it's just like, yeah, probably are a few songs here and there. But in the way that this, every now and again, looks like it could be an episode of Glee.
Yeah, and it's this operatic kind of thing. Yeah, no, it's incredible. And the fact that, like, you had to do that, you have to do stuff like that in, like, 2 days and still pull that out of the magic hat.
Well, sometimes that sharpens the mind.
It's conducive to creativity.
Yeah, definitely. Speed is good.
Yeah. Something, one last question, because often we have a lot of, you know, filmmakers, actors, writers, and, you know, composers, DPs on the show, film workers, like, and who are passionate about film and TV and music and what they do and the industry. I mean, is there someone out there right now working in film or television or even beyond that, theatre, who you haven't worked with before, if you had the chance, you would absolutely love to work with, whether like a director or like a writer, like someone who you think, oh, I could, music to their images, I could do that. That would be great fun, you know, to explore. Is there anyone out there that you would love to work with if you had the chance?
I love Ari Aster, his horror movies.
Yeah.
And I also love Zach, the guy who just directed Weapons. I've forgotten his name. But
is it Kreger?
Yeah, that's it. Mike White, who did, you know...
School of Rock.
No. White Lotus.
Oh, White Lotus. Oh, yeah. Same guy. Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
is
same
it,
guy.
Did he direct School of Rock?
You know, he wrote School of Rock and did quite a few of the songs on it, I want to say, and then did White Lotus late, you know.
But I wouldn't do that because, anyway, it's just got such a fantastic soundtrack already. I did read this conversation about the relationship between the composer and Mike White in the New York Times, and it was quite a good read. You should read it. It's very interesting for me to have read because it's the most wonderful soundtrack.
Interesting. And of the composers working today, are there any that you think are doing particularly great work or your fans
of? God, there's loads. I mean I know this is the end, but the way that music is written and the type of music people want these days is quite different. I mean, a show like Doctor Who, which has lots of different tunes and leitmotifs for different characters, is quite unusual now. It's much more stripped back, and I'm not sure that melody is such a big desirable quality in a soundtrack. You know, in people can be sometimes worried that I like that melody, but some people might not like the melody, so play it safe. I'm not saying everyone plays it safe, but there's a lot of really great composers out there.
Yeah, but I hear what you're saying, though. I feel like there is. I remember Danny Elfman, he once said that something he comes up against quite a lot is the idea from, I guess, producers or higher ups, is that music, oh, it shouldn't be noticed, it should just sort of blend into the background of the picture and play it, and in quite a safe way it just sort of fills the vacuum. And then he, obviously being Danny Elfman, reacts against that because his music is so memorable and it takes risks. And I feel like your music does the same, and I was curious whether you'd ever had to deal with that, whether like there is an idea that music melody is not prized as highly as it used to be.
No, it's everywhere. It's I mean, I was watching over Christmas, I was watching Die Hard, and I think it's Michael Kamen who scored it. And the amount of work that is involved, wait, was it that or was it Home Alone? Anyway, it doesn't really matter, because either of those scores are just huge amounts of orchestration and just tonal complexity. And, you know, the big orchestral scores are make really interesting. They're so sophisticated. I'm not sure that we have that level of sophistication around now. We have a lot of, you know, wonderful music, and especially in the sort of Disney Pixar realm of things, where you're constantly finding new ways to enchant children and lock a new story into their imaginations forever and ever. You know, so there's just some really great stuff out there, but it has changed. It does feel like sometimes it does feel quite safe and quite muted. But yeah, you know, what do you expect? I mean, I've been doing it for 30 years
and doing it exceptionally, if I may say so. And yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the great things, one of the things I love about your music. Just, I guess, just to finish on that, like, your music has always been so memorable, and melody is such a huge part of it, and it demands to be heard. You know, you hear that those songs like The Shepherd's Boy or I Am the Doctor, and you instantly tune in and you keep listening and you don't stop. And that's, you know, one of the things I love about your music, Murray. And what can I say? You know, I'm so happy that you've been happy to chat to us about it on Half the Picture. It's been great. You know, as a fan, it's been, you know, it's a bit of a dream come true.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I'm so sorry if I wandered off into philosophical terrain too much, but that's who I am. I'm just a pretentious twat.
And on that note, we shall draw a veil. Hey everyone, thanks so much for listening to my conversation with Murray Gold. Remember to like and subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode, and stay tuned for more exciting interviews and guests coming soon on Half the Picture.